Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f- So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
All of television history is contained within the Box of Delights.
It was happening in front of us.
Incredible.
In our living rooms. It was amazing.
Guests pick their favourite television moment.
And tell us why they love it.
And is this the episode where Daisy's just been for the interview at the Woman's Magazine?
Flaps.
That's it, Flaps.
Yeah.
Named one of Radio Times' best podcasts of the year.
I don't understand people who don't see the joy in drawing the curtains, a mug of hot chocolate and something nice on TV. Like, what could be nicer than that?
Than having a snuggle.
Exactly.
Nostalgia in bite-sized chunks.
Box of Delights
from Great Big Owl.
The following podcast is a member of the Great Big Owl family.
This will certainly have an adult theme and might well contain strong scenes of sex or violence, which could be quite graphic. It may also contain some very explicit language, which will frequently mean sexual swear words.
What do you like listening to?
Chart music.
Chart music.
You pop-crazed youngsters, and welcome to the final part of episode 51 of Chart Music. The denouement, if you will. I'm your host, Al Needham, and before we get stuck into the rest of this episode, I just want to clear a few things up. Number one, yes, I do know that I promised you a Q&A with David ages ago, so I better get my arse in gear on that. Number two, I've had loads of inquiries about Here Comes Quizzem, the Chart Music pub quiz, and I can confirm right now, yes, there will be a second wave of Here Comes Quizzem. Anyway, we return you to the episode in progress.
There it is. Take Another for a Ride. A fabulous sound there from Lulu. That's going to be a smash hit. At number nine in the charts, we have Moments and Whatnots. In actual fact, here we have Moments without their Whatnots, which is a little bit painful. They're going to sing about Girl.
Hey, what's happening, man? Nothing to it, brother. What it is? Let's talk about what we know how to talk about best.
What's that?
Best girls.
After predicting another smash hit for Lulu, Tone explains that 50% of the next act are here in the studio to do the next single, which is Girls by The Moments and Whatnots. Formed in Washington, D.C. in 1965, The Moments signed up to Sylvia Robinson's Stang label in 1968 and got to number three in the U.S. chart 2 years later with Love on a Two-Way Street, kicking off a run of Billboard and R&B chart hits in the first half of the 70s, but nary a sniff of the charty arse over here. That all changed when they teamed up with label mates The Whatnots, who were formed in Baltimore in 1969 and were making a comeback after 3 years of inactivity. And while this single has done nothing in the US charts, it entered the top 40 over here a fortnight ago, and this week it's gone up 8 places from number 17 to number 9. Now, unbelievably, you won't believe what I'm about to say, but Tony's got the pronunciation wrong.
Oh.
It's the Whatnots, isn't it? It's supposed to be a play on Whatnots. But, you know, he's right to correct stupid Americans who can't talk properly because they say astronauts.
Oh.
So, you know, he's right in that, but he compounds the error by calling them the Whatnots, as if they were a Victorian blemish cream. Oh, Tony, even when you write, you're wrong.
You'd be mortified at that.
I fucking love this song. Mm. I've got a very strong memory of Easter of 1975. Mm. My mum and dad had just managed to get hold of a stereogram, which was a big coffin on legs.
Oh, yeah.
So all of a sudden, the family radio had the radio band with Hilversum on it. That became a bit more available, and they didn't go as mental when I took it into my bedroom or sneaked it out. And I remember sitting on the junior school field, which is somewhere I shouldn't have been, during the Easter holidays, sitting on a grass bank. And this song coming on the radio, because I think David Hamilton played it a lot. And just sitting there in a thunderstorm, but so taken by the music and the stylings of the moments and whatnots, that I didn't give a fuck. I just sat there in the rain listening to it, thinking, oh, this is great.
Radiograms. I mean, yeah, that's fantastic. Radio. The radiogram was my gateway into music, because my grandma had one. And you're right, they're colossal things. They were the size of sideboards, and all they contained was like a wireless set, you know, one of those enormous great things.
Yeah.
And a record player, which I was able to kind of stack. You could play eight singles at a time, you know, if you kind of stack them all up, you know, what would they think of next?
Good Lord.
But yeah, that's what, actually, that's part of what got me into the whole world of music, was the radiogram. But the feel and the smell, not just the vinyl, but the rubber of the turntable and everything like that. And it was just a sort of sensory experience, definitely, that the radiogram offered, that I'm not quite sure that the iPhone does.
No, you can't just put it in the living room and look at it and put plants on it, can you?
No, iPhones. Absolutely, yeah.
There's shit for that.
Yeah.
But this performance, not only have the Moments had to turn up on their own without their mates, they're up against a particularly strident Top of the Pops orchestra here, aren't they? Mm.
The thing is, the record of this, which is great, it's almost uniquely unsuited to the Top of the Pops orchestra, because, yes, it's got a sort of lovely 70s soul sound to it, but it's not like a sort of a lush thing that an orchestra can just sort of copy. Right, it's got a weirdly sort of primitive, almost futuristic edge to it, because it's not really a song, is it? It's almost like a recitation that's got just sort of weird right turns and that. It sounds like they're waiting for sampling to have been invented. Do you know what I mean? It's got that sort of feel to it, where it's just like chunks of rhythm going backwards and forwards. Top of the Pops Orchestra just don't quite get that. So they do it in a sort of forced cabaret style, and because it's not much of a composition, it suffers really badly. And also because it's quite a hard song to sing comfortably, because I mean, I appreciate by 70s rules that there's nothing more seductive than a man singing a whole song falsetto, but when you're doing live three-part harmony singing and the mix is a sludge and the hack orchestra are playing too fast again, It can end up sounding a bit like
looking at the watches.
Yeah, it's a bit
trying to get this done before the pub shut.
Yeah,
it's a bit of a cat's chorus, isn't it?
Yeah,
yeah. There's a very rushed feel, I think, to the whole show. And like you say, the orchestra playing too fast, songs dropping out after about 90, what seems like about 90 seconds. But it's fascinating. It's interesting that there's a Sylvia Robson connection there, because you do feel, you know, that little sort of chat at the beginning, that it's proto-rap in a sense, isn't it? I mean, basically that's what everything is going to be fairly shortly. And of course the falsetto will disappear forever, you know, from sort of soul and R&B until Pharrell comes along. Obviously it's lovely, this. I remember it at the time. It's very open-minded sentiment as well, you know, in terms of the love of females. They're not too fussy.
No,
I was impressed by that, and I felt a bit of a heel, because even at 12 I was beginning to take an interest in girls, but you know, I was shamefully, you know, I was a bit particular myself.
Yeah, not this lot. It's this lot and the body positive Sir Mix-a-Lot.
Yes, of course.
Yes, it's the Black R&B version of "I'll Shag Oatmeal."
Yes.
The line that stands out, of course, is the ones that aren't the best looking are the ones who do the best cooking.
Yeah.
Which, you know, I remember Sarah being quite upset about when your man Montel Jordan raised that again 20 years later.
Yeah.
Fucking hell, why weren't the Moments the judges on MasterChef? You could have got it over so quickly. They'd just get all the contestants at the beginning and go, oh, look at that bloke there. He's all right. Fucking ugly cunt. He's won. Give him the prize.
I think, I mean, obviously, as the song develops, the sentiments become a little bit less laudable, really. And I think, you know, essentially it wants a kind of harem, really, in which the various women have the various virtues. So there's one that's sent off to do the cooking. There's one that he can marry into, you know, the money that he can marry into.
He goes on about he wants five or six of them fine ones. But let's do the maths here. One with a lot of money, plus two with a lot of honey, plus three who do them freaky things, plus four bad mamas who
likes to sweep.
That's 10 women.
It's like the 12 days of fuck me.
Yes.
The thing is, though, like ludicrous sexual politics or ludicrous politics of any kind, right, can be or not be a problem in pop music, depending entirely on the context and the mood and the character. And the reason why it works is that these guys don't seem like smooth, manipulative ladies' men.
No, right? They're just like lovely girls.
Yeah.
They might as well be the goodies, basically, sort of having their own fantasies. Yeah. You know?
But I mean, this impression might be compounded by the vest-wearing Top of the Pops orchestra. But, I mean, here... I mean, yeah, okay, they're singing slightly disrespectfully about women, but they sound more like raggedy street corner braggarts,
yes.
You know what I mean? That passing women pretend they can't hear than, you know, people who have actually got any kind of harem.
Or us lot in the playground in the sort of second year at my school, you know, bragging to each other about our fake birds.
Yeah, so it works as a sort of a teenage boy song. Like, you know those garage punk records like Let's Talk About Girls?
Right? So I gotta love them all, babe, not just a few.
It's really, it's about being an adolescent and living in this hormone haze, wank fantasy nightmare world, which is never quite extinguished in adulthood. Mm. But as an adolescent, you just have no control and no method of turning this fire into something useful. You're just walking around in torment all the time, you know. But it's like that half understood energy has made for busloads of fantastic pop records, you know. It's like this would be a problem here if it was set up to sound seductive and smooth, you know. But it comes out all jumpy and uncontrolled. Also, it's being sung by not especially attractive men.
Yeah.
Let's not beat around the bush.
From a female's perspective, there's a very much of an In Your Dreams vibe about it.
Yeah. This stuff is always about catching the lyric at the right angle. And I think sometimes you could do that because you're clever, and sometimes you can just fluke it, right? And I think they may have fluked this, but... They have still fluked it, right? But, I mean, these are the rules by which it works. It's not some, you know, boring sort of point-missing 21st century thing where every song has to have a certain political worldview as though it was a person, you know, as though it was like a college student or something, rather than a piece of low art with its own dream logic rules, you know what I mean? It's like, no, this sounds stunted and silly. And that's its saving grace. Do you know what I mean?
I'll direct the pop craze youngsters towards Sexy Mama by the moment. That's a fucking tune, that is.
Oh, yeah.
Recorded a couple of years previously, I believe.
What's delayed the whatnots? Does anyone know?
Don't know. The Moments are over on they're over here on tour at the moment, so that'll be it.
Yeah.
And they're nicely turned out, though, the Moments. They've got this powder blue... three-piece suit thing going on, but no shirts on underneath, so it looks like they're wearing a sort of like bra tops. But they carry it off because it's the mid-70s. It's getting on for the final years where you can wear this kind of stuff and expect to get a result on Top of the Pops, isn't it? But I love it, man. I mean, if I ever got married, I'm really torn between my stag night being everybody has to dress up like the Moments doing this. Or everybody has to dress up like gang members of the Warriors and we recreate the whole film in Nottingham. So the following week, Girls jumped 6 places to number 3 and stayed there for 2 weeks. The follow-up, Dolly My Love, got to number 10 in August of this year and then had one more proper hit with Jack in the Box, which got to number 7 in February of 1977. They left the Stang label in 1978 to sign with Polydor, but as the label owned the rights to the name The Moments, they had to call themselves Ray, Goodman and Brown and are still going to this day if you discount a death or two. It's a bit of a Trigger's Broom situation.
Super fine,
mighty fine, sugar and spice, everything, ha ha ha, especially at night.
That's lovely. Moments and the number 9 sound, and that's called Girls. You know the version of The Ugly Duckling by Danny Kaye? We have a brand new version of the same song by a very, very funny comedian called Mike Reed. In fact, this is a very funny version of The Ugly Duckling. Listen now.
There once was an ugly duckling with feathers all stubby and brown, and the other birds in so many words went, oi!
Get out of town!
Oi, mush!
Get out Yeah, you!
Get up!
Move your Irish!
Get out of town!
Hey, that's lovely, says Tony, before telling us about a song and how funny the comedian who's covered it is and how funny the version he's done of it is. It's The Ugly Duckling by Mike Read. Born in Hackney in 1940, Michael Read began his career as a stand-up comedian who fell into acting as a stuntman in the 1960 film Spartacus, and then as an extra in Department S and Doctor Who, and then a stunt driver in Casino Royale, The Dirty Dozen and Chitty Chitty Bang Bang. He was also a bit player in various episodes of The Saint and Roger Moore's underwater stunt double until he was fired for continually taking the piss out of Moore's thinning hair. Oh, get down to Pountney's, Roger. After an appearance in the film version of Steptoe and Son as the comedian before the stripper comes on, he became a key component of The Comedians, the massively successful ITV stand-up show. This led to a record deal with Pye Records in 1973 and the LP Terrific Mike Read Sings Cockney Songs. But it, and the single from it, Life Without You, failed to chart. This is his third single and the follow-up to Freezing Cold in 89 Tuzo, a cover of Prison Colin 89 Cuzo, the 1972 single by Italian singer-songwriter Adriano Celentano with gibberish faux American lyrics, which also failed to chart. This time, however, he's gone for a cover of a song from the 1952 film Hans Christian Andersen, originally performed by Danny Kaye, which he had worked into his stand-up act and was his favourite song. To the astonishment of everyone, it's a new entry this week at number 34, and here he is, in the studio. Oh, hey, cool.
Don't give me Mike Read. But as ever, when you have two people with almost the same name, the first thing you have to think about is who would win in a bare-knuckle fight by braying onlookers. But, yeah, in this case, there's not a lot of uncertainty, is there?
No, certainly not.
3 seconds of the bespectacled Saturday morning drip and have, his, have that fucking guitar shaft right up his fucking arse. He's like, run around now, you cunt!
Yeah, go!
You fucking mug! I'll give him fucking tenders. Yeah, because one thing you can say for Mike Read, R-E-I-D, is that he's not like Jack Duckworth. Right, you know Bill Tarmey, who played Jack Duckworth, who's off-screen would swan about in a white suit with a pocket square, like into tinted specs, smoking cheroot.
Vince Sinclair, his alter ego. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, he's the worst. When
I
first
tell a few jokes, maybe you heard of me.
Took the Duckworth role. Perhaps there's a little of me in Jack. You know, it's still fucking actors, isn't it? It's like class traitors and bellends. At least Mike Read is the real thing. Mm. He's as repulsive and seethingly aggressive and overbearing as he appears on screen.
He's the absolute template for Cockney wanker in Viz, isn't he?
I mean, if you
can just absolutely see it. But at the time, I probably would have felt different. I mean, it's funny now to hear like the word mush. When did you last hear a good mush these days?
Yeah.
I mean, I get it occasionally in repeats of Steptoe and Son and things like that. Mush. Get out of town. I can only think about this, that like obviously it's a kind of compendium of like sort of rhyming slang, you know, cop the boat race and all that kind of thing, and like, you know, the cargo or whatever. I can only imagine really that part of the appeal of someone like Mike Read is that like Cockneys and people from London were as gratified to see themselves represented on TV as black people were in Love Thy Neighbour.
I mean, we are 1 year removed from Yus, my dear.
Yes.
That's to come.
Which was derived from Romany Jones, wasn't it? Remember the vehicle for James Beck, who looked very ill in it, and about 6 months into it, he died. Which I always thought was actually to do with was to do with the travelling community, that it was actually, you know, to do that Romany, but it's not at all. It's just people very, very sort of down on their luck, living in static caravans. And he was in that. But I have a confession to... Well, it's not really... No, it's not a confession. Is it a confession?
Well, we'll be the judge of that, David.
Well, there was time, you know, we're all three of us. There's me and my two younger brothers, who didn't always take me entirely seriously as an older brother. Took the piss a bit now and again. And I do recall that we were off somewhere in my dad's Renault, and there were all three of us in the back. And, of course, this came on the radio. And I'd probably only heard it a couple of times. And I started crying in the midsection. You know when he kind of goes into exile? It always kind of put a lump to my throat. Now, I don't cry in public, and it's unfortunately I'm just one of the old school that kind of, I'm not like John Peel or whatever. You know, I kind of have a code about things like that, and this was the most terrible thing. I really had to kind of stop myself. But, you know, it's a bit enclosed in the back of a Renault. And, of course, they noticed, you know, because I'm desperately trying. It's like trying to hold piss in or something. Like,
it's a confession, yeah. David.
And I was crying, you know, and I could see a little tear rolling down the side of my face. My brother Tony, and the youngest one, said, "Ah, you're fucking crying." We didn't say fucking because my dad was in the car. "Hey, you're crying, aren't you? Ah, you soft git. I've seen this one. He's always crying. He's all back green. Oh, the ugly duckling. I'm so sad. Oh, I can't swing." Sitting at the far end, you know, so I can't swing for him. You know, bad skit. That was your worst thing. Bad skit on you. Hey, bad skit. I don't know if anybody remembers bad skit, but that was, you know, it's a bit like Chiz. It's very much a Leeds thing. Skit, bad skit. It's like, you know, that you've been thoroughly humiliated, basically.
Right.
Yeah. So this, I mean, I didn't, you know, I managed not to cry this time when I listened back to it, you know, but, yeah. So, I mean.
Because you knew what was coming.
Yeah, I suppose there is that. I mean,
were you delighted by the end of the song when it turns out all right?
Well, of course, yeah. But
and then laughed at your brothers.
Well, no, there was no getting around it. It was a thorough humiliation. It had to happen in front of my two younger brothers, the worst possible people in front of whom this could happen.
Were you touched by the moral of this song that breeding is all that matters and nothing you can say or do or think will ever increase or decrease your worth?
I didn't look into it that deeply. No, I didn't. I was just sad for the duckling, basically.
It's true, though, isn't it?
Well, yeah.
You're either a swan, in which case it'll all come good, or else you're a fucking duckling.
Yeah.
And you should know your place and take your lumps.
I agree.
Right in the beak. Now, it's weird being given the ugly duckling as a hero. Because it's like kids having Kim Kardashian as a role model, right? People complain about the so-called hollowness of her fame. You know, that's, you know, who cares about that? That's not the problem. The problem is that it's not really aspirational, because how can you aspire to being an heiress? You either are one or you're not, right? And I don't want to sound like, you know, some hippie educationalist, but you don't learn good lessons there, right? Like, what do you learn from just looking up to people who are lucky? Right? The rich man in his garden, the poor man at his gate. God made them high and lowly, each to his own estate. Is everything that I object to, which is why I hate this song so much.
No, I agree. That
he's having a go at Hans Christian Andersen now.
Yeah, fuck off.
Yeah, I agree that basically an insidious value system remains intact at the end of this song, doesn't it?
Oh, yeah. But I'll take it from Danny Kaye before I'll take it from Mike Reed. Do you know what I mean? We've got to talk about this Cockney wanker thing, because there are dislikable regional stereotypes from every corner of Britain, but the Cockney wanker is the capital of dislikable regional stereotypes, right? Or at least the administrative centre, just assuming control of every situation despite a lack of relevant expertise or understanding, right? The key trait of almost every dislikable regional stereotype is a blend of swaggering, overbearing self-assurance and a sort of deep, dangerous defensiveness. Right? And you get that with like cocky, chimp-walking Manx and whining, finger-pointing Scousers and drunkenly unpredictable Glaswegians and, you know, hectoring, close-minded Yorkshiremen and what else? Sinister Wicker Man building West Country people, you know, because it's patriotism in microcosm.
That's what's great about living in Nottingham. You can't pin anything on us. No fucker knows about us. We're that obscure.
Yeah, no one cares.
Yeah.
But it's a choice, though, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's a choice. It's a hard adherence to the worst of local norms and a sort of boorish civic pride. Like, even like the dumb, docile Brummie, right? you think, well, that doesn't really apply. No, there's a variant of West Midlands stereotype that has a sour, empty smugness to it, right? Like, you know, retired spring maker Harold Court is an example of that, which long-term listeners will know well. So you still don't believe it? No. Why not? I don't. Right, you know. But it's everywhere, right? When people feel that they're simultaneously representing their tiny portion of the world and are represented by it. I mean, it's a horrible situation to put yourself in, but it's the soft option for people who've got nothing of their own, right? And a professional dislikable regional stereotype like Mike Reed is the worst of all, because not only is it overwhelmingly obnoxious, but you think, hang on a minute, this person hasn't just fallen into this. They had got the wit and initiative to make a buck out of a kind of controlled performance of themselves, right? Therefore, they should know better.
I don't know. I mean, in the context of 1975, we haven't been clubbed about the head with the Cockney stereotyping as much as we would in the 80s.
Yeah, I suppose.
You know, this is pre-Bottle Boys and Up the Elephant and Round the Castle and Chaz and Dave and EastEnders and
this
all
is
that.
It. There wasn't an awful lot of representation of this kind of, like, yeah, strongly accented character. Which
And this is the year of Funky Moped, isn't it, as well?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, defend that, Taylor, if you dare.
No. Oh, no.
Yeah, well, of course, the B-side was it was the Magic Roundabout parody, wasn't it?
Yes.
Which he says, piss off at the end. I remember our music teacher playing that to us on a Friday afternoon as a end-of-term treat, and we all fell about.
But you see, the main question raised by this record is why? There's no reason why a shit thug club comic shouldn't cover a Danny Kaye children's favourite. And instead of changing it and making it blue so it's about sex or something, you know, like Magic Roundabout shit, just do it as a kid song, but in his own in his own imitable fashion. But you rack your brain for any reason why anyone would actually think of it or decide that this was a good idea, and they just don't come.
This is the dying days of giving anyone remotely famous a record deal.
Mm.
And he's done better chart-wise than, say, Oh What a Gay Day by Larry Grayson or Rock Steady, the Deedle-Lee song by Little and Lodge when they had a reggae song.
Yeah.
It's strange that this one got through and the others didn't. Yeah. But, you know, thank God. Thank God this is the only one.
Look, it made a boy cry.
Yes.
What can I say? A northern boy. That's a hard thing to do, so obviously had something about it.
I saw Mike Reed in Torquay in 1994, and I have to say that he was probably the best stand-up I've ever seen. You know, I haven't seen many, not really that interested in stand-up comedy, but he had the audience in the palm of his hand.
There were other comedians. There was a guy called Charlie Smithers, who my grandma had a record on occasion, who would bung on the old radiogram, and I think he was kind of London-based, but all of his material was about sort of gays and Pakistanis and stuff like that, just lengthy routines. I'm not sure. I don't know to what extent Mike Reed ever did that kind of stuff.
He was blue, but he wasn't racist. Yes. You know, by this time, in 1975, he is a polished comedian. But fucking hell, tough crowd. Alberto Tarantini's back with his equally sullen mate, and him and all the kids, they're all standing around wearing the Kenny badges. Got this sullen look on their face as if they've been made to look at a cage full of locusts in a biology class.
Yeah, there's a few lads at the back who are really digging it. Well, along at the Cockneyisms. Oh, yeah.
I mean, there's possibly rising impatience at this point, isn't there?
There's two girls at the front who are obviously in on the deal. They've both got duckling puppets.
Yes.
Yeah.
Which they forget to wave about right through the song. And one of them's got a T-shirt that says, Oi Mush, the Ugly Duckling.
I'm that age where I had to grow up listening to Junior Choice.
Yeah.
Helmed in those days by Ed Stewart.
Yes.
Appropriately enough. Years before Blackburn was demoted to such ignominious depths. And the thing about Junior Choice was that the records never changed. It was the same every week. And people would write in with requests. But there's no need, because you were going to hear My Brother by Terry Scott, whether you liked it or not. Or if you were lucky, Right Said Fred by Cribbo, which is a properly imaginative and enjoyable record. Or that I Saw a Mouse, whatever that's called, There on the Stair.
Yeah.
Windmill in Old Amsterdam.
Yes.
Amsterdam,
But this song was another perennial in both versions. And, you know, even then, not pleasant to my tiny ears. Never mind the current worn out, perpetually ringing ears being subjected to this now. And I don't care for the queasy sentimentality of Danny Kaye's version of this. But, I mean, fucking hell, this wasn't required. I look at this and all I can see is it's like having a bully dad on the stage, you know, putting on a show for their nippers, right? And it's always, it's just so deeply repulsive, like a can of London Grill, having this unwanted sort of aggro presence in the nursery. Do you know what I mean? It just doesn't feel right. It's like, stay out of the kids' universe. Just be what you are. Do your aggressive, thin-lipped smile. Work blue. Wear a tweed trilby and a ski jacket. or was that Pete Beale? Wear a tweed flat cap and a ski jacket. And keep the British end up where it belongs, right? Somewhere dark and unhygienic. Don't go on Top of the Pops dressed like an Austin Allegro driver in a public information film.
Yes.
Imagining that you have charm. And trying to be a children's entertainer. It's the way he lapses into that tender crooning voice a couple of times.
I suppose, at least he didn't have the domestic life of Arthur Mullard.
Yes.
This is true. But he does have that stupid fucking daddy dog thing. You know, it's like it's like one of those blokes where everyone has to indulge his little turn or else fear his wrath, you know.
Wallop!
It's like you better laugh at his jokes just in case, because he wanted to be a star and you're making himself the centre of attention now. It's, you know, if you puncture that, he might just take out the grim reality on you, you know. There's always that air about it. Do I make myself clear, sunshine?
I'd be compelled to punch you on your beak.
Yeah, have a chuckle as he shows off his tender side or else, you know. You listen to me, my son. Why? You're not going to say anything good. You know. It's like these blokes who have to be the Kim Jong-un of their own family. You know what I mean? Or their horrible pup.
It's rejection, though, isn't it? It's not like he's Bob Hoskins in The Long Good Friday.
I mean, yeah, it's just minnows fronting, isn't it? Desperate, but at least he loved his dear old mum. All what this really needs is for him to turn into Bill Tarmy at the end with a glide and a whistle and a snowy white suit. Now there's a class act, right? That would be an inspirational story.
So the following week, the Ugly Duckling jumped 12 places to number 22, and 3 weeks later it got to number 10. Its highest position. Fuck it, this is a top 10 song, everyone. He went back to the Danish Well with a cover of The King's New Clothes for the follow-up, but it failed to chart. What a shame, man. He could have turned up with just a fucking dicky bow on Top of the Pops. Could have predated that by 20 years. And he went on to present Run Around later that year and appear as Arthur Mullard's brother in the ITV sitcom Yus My Dear. He had one last throw of the dice in 1999 when he recorded a cover of The More I See You with Barbara Windsor, but it stalled at number 46 in April of that year, and he died at the age of 67 in Marbella in 2007, and this single was played at his funeral.
Shame's an ugly duckling, not I. I think I'll go down the road and give some of these dinners a bit of GBH in the parson's nose. There's one over there. Oi, cocky! Who's a pretty boy now, then? Look at that dolly swan. I think I'll go and blow down her ear once or twice round the lake. Large portion out in the bunny.
Welcome to All Rather Mysterious, the podcast that aims to unlock the mysteries of the past with the key of fact. My name is John Rain.
My name is Eleanor Morton.
My name is David Reed.
Please join us as we present to you mysteries that have baffled the world.
You had any noises?
What about a door creaking?
You don't have to do it.
That so. Weird kadoonk that yeah, lights going off makes for some reason in films.
All Rather Mysterious.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices
down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
There it is. Mike Reed, that's a classic, isn't it? Does it beautifully. Well, that's a number called The Ugly Duckling. Right now, we go to the number one sound on Top of the Pops. What do you know? One of the most popular groups in the country right now. Girls, they are there at last. Originally done sometime back by the Four Seasons. It's called Bye Bye Baby, the Bay City Rollers.
If you hate me after what I say,
can't put it off any longer. Just gotta tell her anyway.
You're the one girl I want to marry. Big tits and an airy fanny. Sorry, I can't not sing that. It's ingrained in me. Oh, by the way, the next line which we sang was, gee, I wish you would pee all over me. Yeah.
Very good. Which, Nothing.
You were quite go-ahead for an infant school in 1975, adding a bit of scat to it.
Amazing foresight as well.
We've already covered the Rollers and this single in Chart Music number 6. It's the follow-up to All of Me Loves All of You, which got to number 4 in October of 1974, is a cover of the 1965 Four Seasons single and, as admitted by manager Tam Payton a few weeks ago, is the first single that the band have actually played on with their own instruments and everything. It entered the chart at number 8 2 weeks ago, moved up to number 2 last week, and this week it's knocked If by Telly Savalas off the toppermost of the poppermost for their first number 1. Oh, it's all about the Rollers at this point, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's their show. I mean, Taylor, you're too young, and as I pointed out when we last covered this song, the Rollers weren't making that much of an impression on the females in the first year of Westglade Infant School. But David, you're practically in an older generation at this time, so what was it like at your school?
Well, I went to an all-boys school. And I suppose I would have had mixed feelings about the Bay City Rollers. On the one hand, they had the thrust that I was looking for. But they were, yes, the whole girly mania thing, I think, was a sort of black mark against them. Plus, I always thought, I didn't really like the cut of Les McKeon's jib, you know. I thought he was a bit sort of, I don't know, Weasley-faced. Something I didn't really care
going around
or
thinking
like
he was summit.
Exactly, yeah. I would have probably quite, you know, grudgingly enjoyed this single on a certain level, whatever. I mean, Roller Mania, yes, it was. There's this kind of continuum of like mania ever since the Osmonds, really. And it's funny because there'd been a kind of 10-year delay, really. I mean, the whole Beatlemania thing, you know, of like people throwing, you know, practically throwing themselves off balconies at airports or whatever, had probably subsided by you know, the mid 1960s. So there's a kind of a long delay, really, before the whole Osmonds thing, and then immediately Bay City Rollers pick up the slack. It just seems feels like a kind of undifferentiated phenomenon, really, you know, and there has to be a different object of these kind of maniacal affections. But it's kind of all pretty arbitrary, really. The tartan thing is interesting because, I mean, you see them performing here and the drummer's kind of smiling sort of sweetly to camera, you know, they are like Lisa Simpson's non-threatening boys magazine fodder. But at the same time, you know, this is the era of the tartan threat. And I think, you know, there is a sort of sense of the sort of prototype punk thing going on in that respect. I mean, there's also like the time, like the tartan armour that used to come down every year for the home internationals you know, to Wembley. And I think it was slightly later than this that, they, you know, when Scotland won 1-0 and they all sort of hung off the crossbar and snapped it. It was 77, wasn't it?
Yeah.
But it generally, in that era, there was this sense of, you know, the boisterous tartan threat, you know, the Caledonians kind of rushing down from the hills to kind of, you know, give the English a bit of a biffing. And and I think there was definitely a sort of resonance about the tartan that despite, you know, as I say, their kind of ostensible non-threateningness, you know, there was something potent about...
Well, they were scrappers, the rollers. They were picked off the street.
Yeah.
Most of them.
Mm. Basic rollers, I didn't know what to make of them at the time. The thing that put me against them was they all looked like William Bell, who lived on the other half of the school and was stereotypical 70s agro merchant.
Mm.
And we weren't playing football yet at infant school, so our kind of like playtime diversion was to stand at the top of a grass bank behind a massive fence and watch William Bell throw bricks at us over the fence. And we'd taunt him, and he never hit anyone, but, you know, he was trying to.
Yeah.
And, you know, to me, William Bell could have been a member of the Bay City Rollers.
But I think it was extremely important that they had that kind of ingratiating aspect about them. You know, they couldn't be like all Peter Cook in Bezazzled, you know, you mean nothing to me. You know, they couldn't have any, or it couldn't be any kind of surliness or standoff or even any sort of sense of menace at all. So, you know, they had to be very, very ingratiating and smiley, perhaps precisely to kind of counterbalance all these other things.
Yeah.
But yeah, they were offering their young female fans the same release that those girls' brothers would have got at the football match.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, rather than anything romantic.
Yeah.
Then again, your older brother wasn't wetting himself at Anfield at Kevin Keegan.
Terry McDermott.
Yeah.
yeah, I caught the long tail of the Bay City Rollers. They were still on telly a lot when I was a kid, even though they were no longer what they were, because, you know, they were involved in that Mike Mansfield world where, you know, you'd still get a bit of a push even when nobody gave a shit. But
I mean, by that time, to you, Taylor, I'm guessing there'd be like a humanoid animal Quackers.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. But so it's only since that I've gone back and, you know, educated myself about the Rollers. And truly, it is the bleakest story ever told.
Oh, isn't it?
I mean, in most of the sorry stories of rock and pop, you know, people get hurt and left behind, or they die or go mad. But at least someone somewhere is having a great time and getting rich and living happily ever after. But not in the Rollers story. Everyone involved is in a nightmare, just continuously. And I mean, even Tam Peyton, right, the evil puppet master.
Yeah.
I don't think he ever got close to true happiness or even basic satisfaction. And what makes the Rollers story so depressing in a way as well, I mean, depressing as opposed to traumatising, is there's a relative lack of drama in it too. There's a lot of really awful, sinister shit going on, but there's rarely a flashpoint or a big reveal or like a Savile moment of out-and-out horror. Even as a story to hear and tell, there's no release. It's just this drag, this oppressive drag that just seems to all be about sustained control and denial and a sort of vague looming threat and emptiness, you know, and misery and waste. It's got that. This is not a group that anyone looks at and thinks, I'd like to be in this band.
No.
No. I mean, you know, Tam Peyton was, in case anyone doesn't know, was a rather unpleasant, predatory man with a taste for younger lads who carefully selected the members of his bands for, shall we say, extra musical reasons. And, you know, however much did or didn't go on between he and they, which is a matter for at least some debate, what's certain is that he absolutely forbade all of them from having any fun whatsoever or any contact with girls for as long as their run lasted, right? Which, I mean, it must have been a bit harsh for young, mostly hetero lads at number one in the charts. I mean, fucking hell.
You're right, the Bay City Rollers is a particularly bleak story. I think that anybody on that particular pop treadmill or whatever, there's immense hardship, you know. I don't think, you know, it would be probably a nicer life or an easier life and a less strenuous life to sort of be a member of Joy Division or something like that than it would to be even Brother Beyond or something like that, or Spice Girl. I mean, like Sporty Spice, whatever, you know, talking about how the whole time at the kind of zenith of their career just being perpetually hungry because, you know, they're to kind of keep their weight down. It's just, you know, it's just things like that. I mean, you're right, it's not an enviable existence at all, and this one particularly unenviable.
Yeah, I mean, normally you see people who are a bit down damaged from the 70s, and they're all right, they're philosophical, and just their hand shakes a bit as they raise their fag to their mouth, you know. But the key fact here, I think, is that over time there were, what, about 8 or 9 people who were in the rollers at some point, and I think 5 or 6 of them have since attempted suicide, and that's not a coincidence. Because not only was their rise to fame so bumpy and compromised, their heyday was just a blur of overwork and frustration and zero artistic fulfilment. And then their decline was just as painful as if they'd been having a good time, right, as well as predictably horrific financially. And it was drawn out to the point of agony. You know, they really didn't want to let go, and yet they seemed to be falling forever. You know, like half of these nuts are still trying to make comebacks this century, you know what I mean? And it's all rubbish. It was all rubbish. That was the thing. There's a really upsetting but amusing clip from German TV, of course, from about 1988, where the 30-something and now rather adult Les McKeown is performing his European hit She's a Lady in a rainy, half-empty funfair in fucking Mannheim or Paderborn or some lifeless ditch in Germany. And he's serenading a hideous animatronic Miss Piggy and headbutting a cardboard cutout of Joan Collins. And at the beginning, he has to come sprinting up this walkway onto the stage for a dynamic entrance, right? But it's been pissing down all day. And the sky is like the dead mouse belly. And he comes running up, and he's obviously, you know, perhaps had a few or a bit of something. And he slips on the wet ramp and just falls flat on his face with the cameras rolling, and scrambles up just a bit too late to reach the mic in time to start lip syncing. So the song begins without him. And you're looking at it thinking, Christ, somebody had to be there doing that. You know what I mean? And it's like everything about it, it's like an icy wind full of crematorium dust just blowing through a hole in the middle of your soul. Jesus Christ. And there's about 10 years of that for these poor bastards.
I mean, great suffering usually produces great art.
Yes.
What is there in the oeuvre of the Bay City Rollers to hold up? I mean, Simon's made a strong case for Shang-A-Lang.
Yeah. Shang-A-Lang and this, basically. This is the Rollers at their peak.
Yeah, this is traveling, this is their best.
Traveling at the speed of darkness.
Yeah, I mean, right about this time, they were in their Twirl King period, weren't they? You know, the yo-yo team in The Simpsons, coming out to bedazzle the youth before being slung in the back of a van to go on to the next thing.
I love how this slowly is mutating into a Simpsons podcast.
Yes.
But yeah, I mean, the Four Seasons version of this song is obviously much better. Right? Like, it doesn't sound thin and cheap, and it's got good singers on it.
Well, yes, indeed. I remember listening to David Hamilton on that radio I talked about earlier, and he played, like Tony Blackburn would do with reggae singles, he played the Four Seasons version straight afterwards, and I was outraged.
Yeah.
I thought, what a fucking cod, singing someone else's song and pretending it's your own. No, I wasn't impressed by that.
Yeah.
I was still young. Still had a lot to learn.
Yeah.
But it just shows the big problem for the Rollers musically, which was the sort of airless, desiccated sound that they had. And like the ban on energy and aggression on these records. So when they get a half decent song like this or Shang-A-Lang, it sounds like an empty room, you know. And you look at them performing, they've got these weak, fixed smiles. And, you know, they've got no sympathy with the material. Like zero exuberance or magnetism. I mean, Les always tries hard, you know. You know, but just generally, there's a sort of, you know, even looking beyond the teen idol thing, just to try and analyse it, there's a sort of almost like a semiotic muteness to this. You know what I mean? It's like there's nothing to engage with.
But that seems to be kind of mandatory, though, with these kind of teen pop phenomena. There's got to be some sort of austerity. Yeah, there's got to be a ban on energy and aggression. There's got to be a ban on enjoying yourself and a ban on sex and a ban on food or whatever. It just seems to be a mandatory feature of people, you know, on that. You know, or if you're the Jacksons, you know, you've got to be kind of like living the appalling despotic regime of Pop Joe. Just seems to be mandatory. Maybe there are examples of people who enjoy kind of teen pop, who are able to kind of thoroughly enjoy the life and give to their richest and fullest and the best of their energies as they do it. But I suspect it might be hard to come by.
But at least the Jacksons sound like that's what they were doing.
Hmm.
Do you know what I mean? Like this lot, it's you look at them and it's like they just...
Yeah.
It's like they mean nothing. It's all they are is icons of their own unhappiness and their fans' desperation.
I think that's a good point, that their actual, the desperate listlessness of it is kind of, it does sort of shine through, doesn't it? I mean, what's strange about this, though, is you're looking at the audience and all the way through I've been kind of thinking, people a little bit under-enthusiastic and sort of tetchy and they're kind of clutching their sort of tartan scarves because there's only one thing they're really here for. And they look as though they're there under sufferance, as quite often Total Pop's audiences do. And I thought, well, maybe there's going to be a great explosion of energy when, you know, one of the biggest bands in the UK finally comes on. And there isn't. And it's clear that for whatever reason, I don't think that, like, you know, the producer there is just like, my God, we've got a pretty listless generation here. You know, we were really hoping for some energy. And I think there is actually a ban on energy from the audience, on, you know, but obviously it's very difficult.
The BBC's clearly dumped it down.
They seem to sort of like, you know, audiences that are hand-picked for unenthusiasm because anything too exuberant. I mean, you know, this is a group that have got people, as I say, you know, sort of like hanging off the edge of balconies, screaming and screaming. You would have thought that, like, okay, we're going to need about, you know, volunteers of 70 or 80 people to watch the Bay City Rollers and be like 6 feet away from them. They've probably deliberately gone for people who don't even know who they are. You know, they're kind of, you know, swats or whatever, who would prefer to be at top of the form or something.
As Simon said, they probably sent out a floor manager to give everyone a stern talk saying, you're right, you know, go to the toilet now before the Bay City Rollers come on. I mean, obviously, when you see Shang-a-Lang, you know, it's rank ITV. Old Muriel Young has obviously, you know, just ramped up the screaming and all that kind of stuff. And look what happens, you know. Cliff kills a police officer.
It's as if they're being... It's as if they're being contravention to some sort of policy laid down by Lord Reith or something like that. If anybody would sort of unseemly enthusiasm would kind of upset the equilibrium of the BBC and the tone they're attempting to maintain all the way through.
But the trouble is, when you see Shang-a-Lang, I mean, it's like, another thing with the Rollers is it's hard to understand their teen appeal because they're not very sexy, right? With a pin-up band, you can at least see what the girls are meant to be screaming at, right? You look at the Rollers, and even in these famished times of chip pan complexions, you know, and poor physical conditioning, they're not very good looking.
I don't know. I mean, Eric is obviously the heartthrob of the band.
Yeah, not letting on that he's almost 30.
And Les is essentially, if Les McKeown wasn't in a band, he'd be one of those 20-year-olds who hang outside schools in his car.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Not in a never go with strangers way, but in a, you know, in an LL Cool J way, shall we say.
Yeah. But the thing with Shang-a-Lang, when you watch it, it's, yes, the fans are going absolutely apeshit. And then the Rollers come out and, you know, it's not like they were hugely charismatic individuals, you know.
No.
But they can hardly speak. It's fucking embarrassing. Yeah. It's a really depressing show, Shang-a-Lang.
It is, isn't it?
It's got that mid-70s...
Woody's impersonation of Frank Spencer is appalling, isn't
Christ.
It?
It's got that mid-70s sort of mugginess and lack of sharpness. And that sort of, like, it's sort of smeared in lard, like shoddy, sort of low quality feeling. Like, for a start, it's hosted by these dummies, and they're reading out lines as they sound like the kids who didn't get picked to speak in primary school assembly. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And there's nothing.
Or why don't you?
Yeah. There's nothing to hold it together because they have no personalities and they can't deliver the lines. And then There's nothing else going on with them to sustain 25 minutes of television, right?
No.
Like, never mind a series, like a seemingly endless series of 25-minute episodes. So what happens is, straight away, in desperation, it lapses into that crap retro thing that you always get as a fallback. You know, that sort of that grubby mid-70s bubblegum, right? And it's all controlled by men of a certain age who, for the first time in the short history of pop music, are young enough to have their own experiences of pop music. They think they're still in touch enough to make decisions on behalf of the audience. But, in fact, they're also old enough to have a gnawing nostalgia for their own youth. So you end up with this slow-motion 50s revival that begins at the tatty end of glam rock, right? All the futuristic energy of glam rock burns out and you're just left with the old riffs, which is all these people understand. On Shang-A-Lang, every week you get that mini history lesson where the Rollers have to lecture an audience of completely uninterested kids about fucking Bill Haley and the Comets or something.
Yeah.
Because some idiot thought they'd be interested or couldn't think of anything else. And, you know, as educators, they're not exactly electrifying.
No.
And
they have to bring out big Jim Sullivan as well, don't they? So, look, here's someone who can actually play an instrument massively proficiently.
Yeah.
Let's watch him on an acoustic guitar.
Yeah. Well, I mean, if you want to know how boring Shang-A-Lang is, you only have to watch the first episode where, like the very first episode, where someone thinks it's acceptable television for the beaming doofus drummer, Derek, the semi-verbal Derek, years before being convicted on child pornography charges, of which he still maintains his innocence, which, yeah, if not, at least he can say he's the least creepy-looking paedophile in 70s pop. He's not, you wouldn't want that as your entry in Who's Who, but it's, you know, there's some people would look on that with envy. So you get Derek to interview a couple of blokes from Lieutenant Pigeon about an album they've just recorded of the sounds of different kinds of trains pulling into the station and then pulling out again. Right? My first girlfriend's dad had some albums like that. But here they are. For a full 5 minutes, there's this confused man-child trying to act like he cares about what is obviously the most overwhelmingly boring record ever made. And these two sort of beardy ale bores who made it, talking about diesel hydraulics in front of this sort of trapped, stultified audience of hormonal Bay City Rollers fanatics. And that's episode one. You know, like, don't come so many times you're too tired to tune in next week, will you? Fucking hell. But they might as well have drawn the curtains and given them a slideshow of scenes from the Holy Land.
Yes. But there's there's that John Craven's News Round around about this time. In 1975 and 1976, there were two John Craven's News Round specials on the Roller phenomenon.
Yeah.
It's the clip they always use of the girl from the West Country talking about the merits of the Rollers and the Osmonds.
Yeah.
You know, one of them's got a tartan gimmick and the other one wears stars and stripes and who'd want to wear that because it's stupid. but the other clip is some household where there's two girls sitting down in their roller gear. They put on all their roller gear to watch a television show, screaming their arses off over the Bay City Rollers while Dad sat there in a vest and a fag on, absolutely not understanding the world anymore. But that's always the thing, isn't it? Any teen phenomenon, it's less about the band that's causing it and more about the kids who are reacting to it.
Yeah.
You know, the only thing worth talking about with the Bay City Rollers are the fans.
Yeah, of course. The reaction, yeah. Mm. And it's possible that had they had a modicum more charisma or whatever, that they might have lasted a little longer as a sort of pop teen pop phenomenon, but probably not really. These things, you know, they're probably as long-lived, stroke short-lived, as any other, really. And and the fact that they are, everything that Taylor says, to them, it's immaterial, you know, so it's something else that matters.
Yeah, musical clackers.
It's a shame, though, isn't it? Because if you love pop music, you really want the top shit thrown together bubblegum band of the 70s to be good, you know, in one way or another.
Yeah.
But they're not. They're just aggravating and tiresome and desolate and much worse than the banana splits. It's like what people with no imagination imagine pop to be, imagined into being, you know. Mm. The only good thing you can say about them is they don't act like heroes. They just go out there and radiate nothingness. So at least there's no reason to hate them. You just feel bad for them. You just feel a sort of poached egg pity and a sort of queasy distance. It's like, you know, they're like flat, unrefrigerated lemonade, the mid-70s. Yeah.
But the tartan.
Yeah, they got a tartan gimmick.
Yes. That's right. We don't want to be wearing stars and stripes. That's stupid.
Yes. Oh, she also went on to say the Osmonds wear anchors. She's quite bemused by that because only posh people wore anchors. I don't know.
You're absolutely right about it being far more about the fans, because the energy and the madness and the noise that is unleashed by this phenomenon obviously is far, far more fascinating. There's far more substance, there's far more aggression, there's far more sex, there's far more everything. All the things that are denied in the Bay City Rollers themselves.
This tartan thing, when it was announced that it's Royal Stuart tartan, which has six different colours, there was an article in June of 1975 in The Observer about a factory in Oldham, because apparently 90% of all tartan in the UK was produced in Oldham. And there was one factory that was making 6,000 metres of Royal Stuart cloth a week. And their output had increased by 600% because of the Bay City Rollers. So, you know, at least someone's making a bit of money out of this without being a paedophile, which is nice.
Makes a change. It was a weird little pocket of Scots mania, wasn't it?
Yes.
Sort of mid to late. So it was this, Mullican Tire, 1978 World Cup.
Yes, Ali's Army,
Yeah, Nessie. Yeah.
But of course, you know, this is only the beginning for the Rollers at this point. On the cover of Melody Maker this week, announced a UK tour, and that is going to be fucking almshouse right across the country this summer. I mean, I remember looking in the paper every morning to see if anyone had died at a Bay City Rollers gig the night before. It was fucking insane.
Yeah.
It turned out that they actually played a secret gig in Northern Ireland. There was a newspaper article in the Daily Mirror called The Big Bay City Secret. Oh. Those new sensations of the pop world, the Bay City Rollers, revealed their big secret last night. They played before a packed house in one of the most dangerous parts of Britain, the Creggett Estate in Londonderry. Their words, not mine. And throughout the hour-long performance, the Rollers were guarded by professional IRA gunmen. They played the secret gig during a recent tour of Ireland after announcing that they were taking a couple of days' rest. At least 30 provos wearing black berets and dark glasses guarded the group as they played in a church hall. Manager Tam Payton said it was our contribution to help the young people of Ireland to forget the violence and learn what other youngsters all over the world are enjoying. It's like, fucking hell, Bay City Rollers, they have their own S1Ws.
Mm. Absolutely. And they make all that fuss about Mo Molan.
Yeah.
Still, it's the... It's nice for the IRA to welcome some Scottish people to Northern Ireland for a change.
So, Bye Bye Baby would stay at number one for 6 weeks, finally giving way to Oh Boy by Mudd in the first week of May. It would sell nearly a million copies, becoming the top-selling single of 1975, and keeping There's a Whole Lot of Loving by Guys and Dolls, Fox on the Run by Sweet, and Honey by Bobby Goldsboro off number one.
Boo.
The follow-up, Give a Little Love, got to number one for 3 weeks, and they closed out 1975 with Money Honey getting to number three in December. They would go on to bring their brand of rock and roll chaos to the streets in April, by which time they contributed to the death of a police officer, Les McEwen had knocked down and killed an old woman in his Ford Mustang, caused loads of fans to run across a racetrack in Mallory Park while Noel Edmonds, John Peel, Annie Nightingale and Emperor Roscoe were having a race, and Les McEwen hit a trespassing fan in the face with an air rifle. They spent 1976 trying to break America, and both their single releases, Love Me Like I Love You and I Only Want to Be With You, got to number four over here. As Diminishing Returns set in, the band splintered when Les and Woody started lamping each other on stage in Japan in 1978. Then they fired Tam Payton and struggled on under various isms and schisms until, well, this very day.
One Sound, the Bay City Rollers, and Bye Bye Baby. We've got to say bye bye. We're going to leave you with the Osmonds. See you on Radio 1 tomorrow at 9 o'clock and next week for Top of the Pops. Bye bye.
Tony briefly shills his Radio 1 slot tomorrow and hopes we'll be back next week before signing off with Having a Party by the Osmonds. We've already covered Ken and Donna in chart music number 3, and this single is the follow-up to Love Me For A Reason, which got to number 1 for 3 weeks in September of 1974, in between When Will I See You Again by the 3 Degrees and Kung Fu Fighting by Carl Douglas, the Ramadan number 1 of 1974. It's the second single from the LP Love Me For A Reason, at a time when the band have come back together after Donny Osmond has been spun off as a solo single and also as one half of Donny and Marie, and family members Marie and Little Jimmy have been pushed upon the world. It only reached number 43 on its first week of release, however, and 3 weeks later, it's gone up 2 places from number 30 to number 28. So here's the second screening of the video, or at least bits of it. Before we get stuck into the Osmonds, we've got to wheel back and come forward with something that was brought up in the last episode of Chart Music. You dancing to Kung Fu Fighting, Taylor?
Yeah.
That happened?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
The only inaccuracy in that story is that it's often told as though I was somehow embarrassed. Because in fact, I was having a fucking brilliant time and I only wish I could get that drunk more often.
Oh, so this, how times change, eh, chaps? 17 months ago, the Osmonds were so massive in the UK that they were given an entire week of nightly shows on BBC One, which peaked when they co-presented Top of the Pops with Noel Edmonds. And that episode culminated with the Osmonds dancing to the instrumental of this very single with the 3 Degrees, while all the other bands stood behind them and looked on with a lean and hungry look. And no look was leaner or hungrier than the look being shot at the Osmonds by the Bay City Rollers, who were on that very episode with Summer Love Sensation. Well, look who are the masters now, Osmonds. It's almost poetic, isn't it?
Yeah.
What a compare and contrast of fortunes.
We are Osmonds, King of Kings. Look upon our works and despair.
Yes.
Relegated to the end credits. Ugh.
Yeah.
Yeah. And also, it's a bit unconvincing. Having a party. It's like, oh, the Osmonds are having a party. Watch out. So that doesn't get too out of control. I mean, what kind of a party is this? The Republican party. I mean, look, I've long since lost touch with young people, right? Largely because I now can't speak to them without sounding like the pilot out of Airplane. And or at least someone who makes cultural references like the pilot out of Airplane, which leave them staring blankly. But I'm pretty sure this has never been anyone's idea of a fucking party.
No.
Oh, what's going to be there? What is it? You, not even Coca-Cola.
Milk.
Well, the Bay City Rollers would be all right with that, because according to Tam Payton, that's all they drink. They love their milk.
Yeah.
They're like Caledonian Humphreys.
I guess the only appeal of an Osmonds party would be 7 girls for every boy, because it's the religion. I mean, I think the first time the Osmonds were on air, I mentioned that during the period in which they were successful, i.e. this period, the official position of the Mormon Church was that black people could not hold any position of any kind within Mormonism because they didn't possess fully functional souls. And that does appear...
Well, Wiggins-ovations prove them correct on that, haven't they?
This does appear to provide some explanation for the music of the Osmonds, which is like suffocating in mayonnaise.
Yeah, it's I think it's like a homeopathically dilute version of like Sly Stone in the Dance to the Music era. You know, this whole exhortation, really, that they're trying to get going. Yeah. Really, it's pretty empty stuff, really, from a group whose existence is now entirely unnecessary.
Yeah. Yeah, and this is supposed to be like a soul stomper, isn't it? Like, it needs to have been recorded in, you know, Muscle Shoals or somewhere, and delivered with a rich, throaty voice, like a voice which is enough to listen to by itself. Because this is not a whistling tune or a piece of melodic craft. This sort of song is a vehicle for a performance, and nobody anywhere along the line seems to have understood this, that this sort of song requires a remarkable delivery to be anything at all. So in the absence of a charismatic performance, it's just been crammed with overdubs and tooting horns and like these sounds of impersonated enthusiasm in the background, like people going, woo, hey. Like, and they've stuck in key changes and compressed the recording to just everything to make it sound
in
exciting.
The kitchen sink. And
it doesn't. Yeah. It just, all that happens is it sounds overlit and it's glaring and it's too close to you. You know, it's like, what it sounds like is a 30-second intro tune to a Saturday morning cartoon series or something, right? That isn't even meant to function as music, just a sort of a fanfare, you know, or a quick blast of a whistle to get everyone's attention. It's like that, but stretched out to a full 3 minutes, and it hurts a bit, doesn't it?
It is. It's desperation. It's whistles and deedy boppers and clown buckets of tinsel and stuff like that. And it seems to be a theme throughout this show. This desperation, this sort of everything at the kitchen sink attempt to kind of galvanise these kind of rather unimpressed, inert youth who, and is that to do with the innate inertia of the youth in 1975, the pop kids, or is it just the crappy bill of fare that they're being presented with?
Yeah.
It's not been a good start for 1975 for the Osmonds over here. They had comeback gigs lined up at Earl's Court in January, but they were postponed. At the time this episode was broadcast, they can't pencil in replacement dates until the government announced the date of the Common Market referendum, as they've already bagged the venue first for vote counting purposes. So, you know, Europe's holding back the Osmonds. But it's a very strange follow-up to it. This is the third single that's a follow-up to a number one. And it's a strange choice because the song's obviously been about for 18 months because they were dancing to the instrumental to it on Top of the Pops. And it's also a really weird release time because this is more of a Christmas thing, isn't it?
I suppose.
Yeah, who has a party in March? Not in the 70s. You have two parties a year.
Yeah.
Birthday and Christmas.
That's right, yeah.
So this is your birthday in March. This is altogether inappropriate.
Yeah, they are starting to look over the hill as well, like they're putting on weight and stuff, you know what I mean? What they're wearing here is a fusion of like Western style tailoring, like sort of chamois leather fringe jackets, like sort of cowboy suits, and those pure 70s shirts that are coloured like someone just randomly stuck a pin in the RGB wheel, you know, and made out of some sort of viscous inorganic fibre. It looks really weird, and it's not that flattering to a bunch of lads as lumbering and frankly pudgy at this point as the Osmonds, because tight suede bell buttons with a lace up fly were not really designed for blokes with thighs shaped like country hams, you know, like a real sort of like chub eating Utah lumps. I mean, not to be unkind, but a couple of these lads got the kind of legs where if they sat down naked and looked down into their own laps, it would look like two Mr. Greedys facing each other, arguing over a dropped sausage. It's quite appropriate that they hail from Ogden, Utah, because, you know, that's what they look like they're growing into, you know, like sloping off down the Rovers in a donkey, dribbling into their chin. It's like what Harry Maguire is going to look like when he's 50, you know what I mean? But, I mean, fuck it up, we've all grown a little bit out of shape in lockdown, apart from the Joe Wicks fanatics with enormous front rooms, just from, low step count and surging cortisol. But what's the Osmond's excuse? You know what I mean? Yeah. So do Mormons not recognise the sins of gluttony and sloth?
Except, having said that, I mean, there is at least a sort of rather desperately empty attempt at energy. I mean, you can contrast the sort of listlessness of Basie to Rollers, you know, that you talked about, but of course they don't really have to do anything because they're being adored for some other reason altogether than their own intrinsic qualities. And you contrast that with the listfulness, as it were, of the Osmonds here, but, you know, to very little avail, really, because it's not... It was never really about them or their energy or their qualities or otherwise.
All right, a party held by the Osmonds or a party held by the Bay City Rollers?
Exactly. I don't know. I think I'd go to the Osmonds party and then make my excuses at lunchtime. And you know.
Yeah,
because the lyrics are odd. Because it starts off with "It's Saturday night and my parents are out of town." Told all of my friends at school that tonight we're going to boogie down.
My six parents are out of town.
And then all the girls arrive. All the prettiest girls in the neighbourhood. The ugly ones are probably in the kitchen.
Right,
making sausage rolls or whatever. Mm. And then they've got the latest records. The music's up as loud as it can go.
Yes.
Which is probably not that loud. Mm. And then it gets to a really chilling part of the lyrics. This is why it's probably cut away, because this is the weird thing. Even Top of the Pops, they can't be bothered to show the whole video.
Yeah.
They cut back to the lights every now and again, don't they?
Yeah, yeah.
But there's a part in the lyric which sends a chill down the spine. Take a look at little brother. He's a dancing fool. Watch him do the locomotion. Hey, man, he cool. This is Jimmy Osmond we're talking about. And then at the end, it gets really weird because it says, oh, here come Ma pulling up in the drive. Everybody make a run for it because there ain't enough places to hide. Why's Mum come back on her own? What's gone off?
Yeah. It's also poignant that it's about the latest records that they've got. I wonder if the Bay City Rollers are among them.
Yes.
Yeah, and watch out, because it's Mam number four. She's the angriest. Mm.
Yes.
They really do look like a group who've shot their last bolt here, don't they?
Yeah,
it's so
they
awful.
Really do.
Is that the last halfway interesting thing they ever did was that LP, The Plan, which is a grotesque prog bubblegum album. Which is all the purpose of it was all to try and flog their stupid religion to hormonal adolescents, right? Through this really stodgy and doughy, over-ambitious music. And it's got a sort of Vanity Publishing feel to it. Do you know what I mean? It's like when you listen to it, it's got like a complete absence of control or cohesion or outside discipline. And it's even got that crappy homemade-looking cover. Like those albums that religious nuts make on their own money, you know. But they were superstars at the time, so they were just allowed to get on with it. That was 2 years prior to this, which could be why this has got that sort of half-hearted, sort of spunked-out feel to it, you know. It's like they've delivered their masterwork and done their holy duty, which nobody really gave a shit about because it was terrible. So what's left but the dull clutter of meaningless worldly concerns, like having a party. And so they can barely lift their feet off the ground, you know what I mean? They're just sat at home cramming white bread into their mouths and trying to pretend that the religion to which they've devoted their lives isn't actually a ludicrous con job, which it so obviously is. So what's left? They're just waiting for the sweet summons from the heavenly horn section. So they don't have to do any more of this shit.
I suppose the one thing about the Osmonds, a strange thing, I suppose, if you stretch the kind of, you know, the full set of siblings, is Marie Osmond. I mean, not just the kind of weird, strange dynamic between the two siblings when she duets with Donny Osmond, all of those romantic songs, which is always a bit... But when the time that she read out the text by the founder of the Dadaist movement, Hugo Ball, Caruana, which is like one of the most extreme...
What?
Works of the 20s. And it was some show, some themed show, and it's on YouTube somewhere. Marie Osmond reading out one of the kind of great Dadaist texts, and she does it, and she does it. You know, she doesn't. I don't think she. I think she's just been presented with it and asked to read it, but she makes a pretty decent fist of it.
What's this for?
It was some TV show. So it's on YouTube. You just put in Marie Osmond, Hugo Ball, and there it is.
And then she went on to sell dolls of herself on QVC.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, man. I worked at QVC for a year or so.
All right.
Really hoped to run into Marie Osmond, but I didn't.
Oh.
I did get to share a table in the canteen with Joan Rivers. Oh. Yes, yeah, directly opposite her. But I didn't want to say anything.
Did she say something cutting to you?
No. No, she didn't. No, she looked fucked off. But I also had a fag break in the company of Paul Lavers, the great Paul Lavers.
Mr. Midnight.
Yeah, and Tony Blackburn.
Wow. Ah.
Yeah. But I didn't say anything because I was in awe, and they didn't say anything particularly memorable, so I can't relate that story, unfortunately. No. But yeah.
Is Tony a smoker?
No, he just wanted a nice stand in a Battersea car park and get away from the hell of QVC for a bit. Tony's not a smoker.
It's like kissing an ashtray.
Nah. There's actually going to be an Osman special on BBC One on Easter Sunday, which is in 10 days' time, with special guests Andy Williams and Isaac Hayes.
Wow.
Isaac fucking Hayes and the Osmonds.
Yeah. Mm. Oh. Well, you know, there's nothing you can tell Isaac Hayes about stupid con job religion.
No. Oh, if only Isaac Hayes had done a fucking 20-minute version of Crazy Horses.
Oh. Well, like 60 BPM. Oh, yes.
Yes.
Or Long-Haired Lover from Liverpool.
Yeah. Fucking hell, yes.
Ow.
So, the following week, We're Having a Party dropped two places back to number 30 and stayed there for 2 weeks before slithering down the charts. The follow-up, the title track from their new LP, The Proud One, righted the ship when it got to number 5 in June of this year, but diminishing returns set in, and by the end of 1976, I Can't Live a Dream scraped in at number 37, their last top 40 appearance in the UK, until a re-release of Crazy Horses got to number 34 in June of 1999. And that, me dears, is the end of this episode of Top of the Pops. But there is a voiceover advert at the end for Super Beebs, the best of Top of the Pops, their first ever compilation LP featuring Kung Fu Fighting, Hey Rock and Roll, Sad Sweet Dreamer, Hello, Hello, I'm Back Again, Laughter in the Rain, and 9 other original tracks, available in all good record shops for £2.46.
That's £3 in today's money.
Yes.
Perhaps even more.
So what's on telly afterwards? Well, BBC One piles straight into Are You Being Served, where Mr. Lucas conspires to throw a sicker so he can go on a date, followed by the documentary series Taste for Adventure, where a collector of steam engines tries to purchase some Zambian locomotives. After the 9 o'clock news, Elizabeth Taylor stars in Mrs. Palfrey at the Claremont, this week's play for today. Then it's midweek with Ludovic Kennedy, the weather, regional news in your area, and they close down at 11:30. BBC Two is 10 minutes into part 3 of Late Call, the Dennis Potter dramatisation of the Angus Wilson novel about life in a West Midlands new town. Then it's the penultimate part of the documentary series The Roman Way, followed by Dave Allen at Large. Man Alive looks at the first 3 days of the Clifford House Adolescent Unit in London, then it's News Extra with Angela Rippon, then Second City Firsts, a season of new plays from Birmingham. This week, Alison Steadman knocks off a student in Early to Bed, written by Alan Bleasdale. Then Julian Glover reads Folk Wisdom by Thomas Kinsella before they close down, also at 11:30. ITV has just started Man About the House, where a bodged DIY job means that Robin, Chrissy and Joe have to move in with George and Mildred, and Robin has to share a bed with Tony Blackburn's wife. No, with yes. George. Then the Current Affairs show this week, and then Jack Regan goes out of his way to prove that a convicted prisoner on parole, played by Dim out of Clockwork Orange, was framed in the Sweeney. After the news at 10, Judith Chalmers and Jim Lloyd piss about in the Austrian Alps and the Spanish plane in Wish You Were Here, followed by What the Papers Say, People and Politics, Escape, and they close down as late as 25 whole minutes past midnight. Fucking hell, ITV, calm it down. So, chaps, what are we talking about in the playground tomorrow?
Well, I think it's going to be Funky Gibbon, really, to be honest. Mm. They were just goodies obsessed. I remember this. I mean, it's really sad, really, because around this time, you know, we ought to write an essay about our kind of favourite show, and all the kind of hip kids, you know, wore our collars outside of our kind of, you know, lapels and stuff like that, and our ties in big knots. You know, of course, we were into the goodies. And then there was like this poor lad called Chris Melody. He was kind of the cup that cringeworthy of the class. And in his essay, he decided, "My favourite television programme is Dad's Army. I love the dumbling antics of Captain Mannering and the platoon." And we did, you know, and it just got like jeered down. As soon as he said, "Dad's Army," I mean, that's silly. Of course, he was right. Of course, Dad's Army is better than the Goodies. But no, it was, you know, such were the times that it would definitely have been the Goodies.
Yeah, yeah, the Goodies. As usual. What else are you going to talk about in the playground?
And what are we buying on Saturday?
Packet of chocolate digestives.
I probably would have bought Funky Gibbon. Don't think I'd have stretched to anything else, to be honest. There are certainly better records here, but one or two anyway. But I think I'd have just stuck to the Goodies, to be honest, because, you know, money was tight.
Yeah, at the time, the Goodies for sure. But I mean, obviously now it would be the same as all the Top of the Pops is from this particular area, which is just all the souls.
Exactly, yeah.
Yes, including Wigan's Ovation, eh?
Mm. Oh, God, yeah.
And what does this episode tell us about March of 1975?
I don't know. It was an awful, long time since 1972, and it was an awful long way to go before 1981.
Yeah, it's sweat and polyester and cigarette fog and open upfront passions but hidden suppressed fears and neuroses, which is pretty much the opposite of now. The only thing that does seem familiar is the sense of drift, you know, towards God knows what, and very few things that one drifts towards are good, you know what I mean? People tend not to drift towards rescue or drift towards revelation. You know, you remember when we were talking about skiing in the snow?
Yeah.
And I said, is this the only top 40 single with a double I in it? Pompeii by Bastille is the other top 40 single with a double I in it. Yeah. Oh. I thought it might be Blue Hawaii by Elvis, but that wasn't a single. Katy Perry released a single called Harley's in Hawaii. Hey, that sounds glamorous. But it never made the top 40.
Right. Wow. Hawaiian Wedding Song by Julie Rogers got to number 31 in 1965.
Ah, shit.
And I'm guessing I Moosey doesn't count, does it?
No, it fucking doesn't.
Yeah, bastards.
Yeah.
There we go.
Good one, Taylor.
And that, me dears, is the end of this episode of Chart Music. Usual promotional flange, website www.chart-music.co.uk, facebook.com/chartmusicpodcast, reach us on Twitter at chartmusictotp, money down the G-string, patreon.com/chartmusic. Thank you very much, Taylor Parks.
Cheers.
God bless you, David Stubbs.
And yourself.
My name's Al Needham, and now we've talked about that, let's talk about this. What's that? Girls, right on.
Chart Music.
GreatBigOwl.com.
Oh, hello you. My name's Tom Price.
Hello, I'm Dave Cribb.
You should come and join us. Every day we do a podcast called Cabin Fever, where we talk to loads of comedians who've had to cancel everything else in their lives, so they come on our podcast instead, don't they, Dave?
Yeah, it's an isolation podcast.
Dave, were you yawning at the start of that sentence then? Was it just a little yawn?
Yeah, it's basically the Great Big Owl isolation podcast. We'll have people on from all our podcasts, from your Rule of Threes, your Brian and Rogers, your Musicals, your Bitchins. If you like any of our podcasts, if you like any of those people, chances are they'll be logging onto the Zoom call and just chatting, because let's face it, they got nothing else to do.
Also, there'll be a quiz on the bill. All right, see you soon. Lots of love.
Cabin FE83709. Oh, 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 that's our Twitter name.
When you know you're going to be on stage, you want to make sure that you look your best and that you're properly dressed for the part. Appearance was especially important to a gentleman named Hugo Ball. He was a poet and a leader of an artistic movement called Dada. A hat like this was part of his costume, which looked like this. The number 13 on the cardboard tube that covered his face had nothing or everything to do with his performance. Dada artists didn't claim to make sense, but they did want to make unconventional artistic statements. Most of them as a form of social protest. In this case, the statement included waving a small flag while reciting a nonsensical poem. The poem was written and first performed by Hugo Ball in Zurich in 1916. And it remains to this day a classic example of what Mr. Ball called sound poetry. Here's what it sounds like. A totally imaginary language invented by Mr. Ball. Kawani jolifanto blumba o fali humbla. Grossiga me pafla habla horami gaga gorman. Hai globlo aikora sula huju. Holaka holala. An logobang, blagobang, blagobang baso futaka. Shampa uwala wasa. Olobo. Hechtada gorame sej zumbada. Wulubu susuba de uluwa susuba de tamma. Baumf. Kasagama. Baumf. It didn't make any sense, but it wasn't supposed to make any sense. But nevertheless, Mr. Ball's performance got a rousing ovation and turned out not to be a passing fancy, but a new art form, sound poetry.